So good afternoon, everybody. Yep, good to see you all. I think I saw some of you from last week, and it's great to see you back here this week. So I'm sure some of us are still digesting what we have learned last week. And I know topics are very advanced and, you know, in-depth, so I'm sure the effort that we have to digest all the information is needed, so I'm sure I'm still taking my time to do that. But anyways, all these facts and terms that we learned last week, the evidence and history of Bibles, you know, are, you know, something I'm not good at, and I'm glad to be here to hear it. And it's a good thing, because, you know, as we will know more about the history, the Bible, the evidence, these origins of facts and stuff, you know, we can clear, you know, more about the doubts that we have toward the Bible, toward the resurrection of Jesus, and, you know, where Jesus came from, where he lived, what he did, you know. So I think we can be a bit better witness of Jesus Christ, and our attitude toward everything would change by doing this. So let me just read a Bible verse from the 2 Kings, chapter 3, 16. He then said, God's word, dig ditches all over this valley. Here's what we will have. Here's what will happen. You won't hear the wind. You won't see the rain. But this valley is going to fill up with water, your army and your animals will drink their fill. So I'm sure that as we dig deeper, we desire more from God, and he'll give it to us. He'll give more knowledge to us. And today is our honor and pleasure to have Dr. Emmanuel back with us, and I am seeing him almost every week, and which is a good thing. Thanks for being here. So he's going to continue with the second part of the series today.
I'm on. It's very loud. That was okay. Doing two jobs at once. Most of you are over here, but my slides are over there. I don't know if that's just a habit thing, but I just thought this would have been the better place to sit, but it's okay. First of all, are there any questions from last week? Before I start hitting you with more things, you may or may not have seen them before. Any questions at all from last week? No? There's nothing. Everything was crystal clear. That said, let's see if the clicker works first of all. Let's just see it. Okay. Okay.
Not even this one.
That worked. You see? There we go. Whew. Okay. Overview, right? So let's very quickly review what happened, what we did, everything we went through last week, and then we're going to get an idea of where we're going this week in the next few hours. Last week, I spoke about some of the sources that I was using. I was abbreviated on the sources that I gave you. We spoke about Josephus, who's probably the most important source from the first century, as well as some Dead Sea Scrolls. I mentioned Philo of Alexandria as well. Those are probably the most important sources, and the Book of Maccabees, Maccabees 1 and 2. There is a Maccabees 3 and 4, but they're not as historical. They're more kind of like wisdom books. And they're less common. So those were the major sources that I was actually using. And you'll see from time to time, I'll put things up from these sources. And for oftentimes, that's where we have the historical records. Moses. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Josephus is a history book. basically a history book, so it's not a religious book, so to speak. So it's not something. First of all, I don't think we're in a place where we're reading any of that for doctrine anyway. It's not part of our canon. So Josephus is a history book. A lot of these books were written before Christianity, so they're not really going to be aimed at Christianity. They're not going to try to sell Christian doctrine in any way. But they were written before or at the time of the nascent church, the growing church. So they never really came into contact with it so much. So Josephus' history, he's very Jewish oriented, but he doesn't really interact with Christianity that much. The book of Maccabees was written before Jesus was born. Jesus would have known about it. So again, it's something that it was before Christianity. It's not claiming to be Christianity, anything Christian at all. The fact that the Catholics and some Orthodox churches have it in their canon, that's up to them, but we don't use it like that. Book of Philo is absolutely not. Philo is, he lived in Egypt. He relates occasionally to what goes on in Israel. He would have lived about the time of Jesus, around about that sort of time. No real contact with Christianity at all. Same with people like Herodotus. These were historians. So there's no real, it's not as though we're dealing with, if I were dealing with things like the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas, these kind of texts which are really parallel with scripture that we have, then it gets a bit different. But I'm not really dealing with that type of thing at all. And we're talking about the Mishnah and the Talmud, the Mishnah particularly as well. Again, this is a Jewish book, so we're not looking for doctrine in any of that. It's not really that relevant at all. And I would emphasize again, where we're dealing now, there's a big difference between, and this is a question of, I often get asked about what I do for a living. There's a big difference between text and history and theology. There are huge differences. I don't do theology really at all. I don't touch theology. Obviously in the church context, I'm aware of it. I know, systematic theology, I've done that. But that's not the bulk of my work. The bulk of my work is looking at what texts say, looking at the history and seeing how it interacts with the text, looking at society, looking at language, how it interacts with the text. But the question of theology is a different question, a very different question entirely. And you have to have different disciplines going into it. You have to have, your understandings of philosophy, your understandings of logic, your understanding of church history and everything else. And that's really, we're keeping those two things really quite distinct. I'm in the world, and at least for us now, we're in the world over here. Stuff of theology, I'm sure there are people who are much more qualified than myself to deal with something like that in a context like this. So I make that point of distinction. But good question. It needed to be clarified. It does need to be clarified. We had a historical overview as well, where we looked at the periods involved. We looked at the Persian period, first of all, which was the period from that kind of overlaps with the end of the Old Testament, which discusses. We looked at Ezra, Nehemiah, those days. Ezra, Nehemiah would have been Zechariah, Malachi, Haggai, those prophets. That was the Persian period. And then from there we came down into 333, very important year. That's when Alexander the Great came and inaugurated this larger Greek empire into the area of Israel. And then from there he had the generals after him, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, still in the Greek era, but they took over the managing of Israel. And throughout most of that time, it's important to realize, we'll see because it relates to what we have speaking about today. Throughout most of that time, it's important to realize that Judah was a small, landlocked region, district. It was not a larger state. And it was during the Greek era, towards the end of the Greek Empire, that we have the rise of the Hasmoneans, this Jewish dynasty that arises, that expands the size of Israel. And as far as the nation goes, it brought back a lot of Hebrew language, it brought back a lot of nationalism. They made some negative changes as well, but they really revolutionized the country, the nation, and put it on the map to a degree. It gets taken up to another level, as we'll see later on today, but that was very, very important. The Hasmoneans, their rule ended a bit later on when the Romans came in 63 BC. In 63, the Romans came, they took over that part of the world. They removed the Hasmonean dynasty, they removed the Greek empire as well, and they brought in their own society, and they made a number of changes throughout the districts and the areas, and they ultimately they ended up managing Israel through kind of like local leaders. And then the Roman Empire goes on, obviously it goes on till much later than we're concerned with, but there were two revolts. There was the revolt in 66 to 70, which was a very big revolt. That was when the temple was destroyed. That's what Jesus prophesied about. And that's when, I can't emphasize enough, it was catastrophic. Because after that, essentially, the center of Judaism, the religious life, is destroyed entirely. And they have to recreate how they understand their God, how they understand worship. Christianity was obviously very well positioned to do that, because Jesus was preparing people to move on without the temple and without a specific place of worship. So that happened in AD 70, and then later on in AD 34, there was another Jewish revolt led by Bar Kokhba, who they had maybe about a year or two of control of autonomy, but was ultimately destroyed by the Romans, by Hadrian, after a very long and drawn out battle. And that's pretty much where it ends. Jewish history in Israel ends for us. Obviously it goes on in different contexts. So we talked about the history, we looked at the linguistic context of the New Testament, we looked at Aramaic, which was being used, we looked at Greek, which was being used, we looked at a bit of Latin, which would have been known, but most importantly was the idea, and this is still the very, very, very strong point I want to make, the idea of Hebrew as a spoken living language in the first century. That is a point I really want to emphasize to you. It was very much alive and kicking. There were documents being written in it at the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Bar Kokhba period. People were writing in Hebrew, not just purely religious texts, but they had rule books, they had writing tablets, it was being taught as a living language in the first century. So that's very important to remember in the background, and that will affect some of the things we look at today as well. We looked at some sects and sectarianism, we looked at the various groups, we looked at the Essenes, who lived in the Dead Sea area. We looked at Sadducees, we looked at Samaritans, we looked at Pharisees, and we looked at, was it just those four? I talked a little bit about the Hasidim, but that was quite a bit separate. I tried to look and see which area did Jesus fit best in, and my supposition was that the Pharisees, he seems to be closer theologically with the Pharisees than any of the other groups. I'm not saying we should all be Pharisees. And we talk about the Galilee, what it looked like, the landscape, Upper and Lower Galilee, where Jesus came from, his environment, what it was like to live in a village, the Dead Sea area. We spoke about that and how he would have been viewed, more importantly, as when he came down to Jerusalem. How would they have looked upon him? It would have been as very much as a foreigner. And another important fact, even though he was from a farming village, from a small village up north, he would have been educated. And we're going to see that again today when I talk about a little bit about Jesus' teaching. Jesus knew things. His teaching was very, very sophisticated. It was not, there's kind of like an idea that that Jesus was some small, ignorant farmer who just kind of built up his own logic and his own means of teaching, and he taught that way. But it's not. When you look at what he's doing, he would have had some very, very good instruction at some point in his life. He was able to pick up a lot of instruction during his life. So that's what we have on the Galilee. This week, what are we going to look at? We're going to come back down and focus in the south some more. We're going to talk about Herod the Great, first of all. I'm going to sort out a lot of the issues concerning the various Herods. We're going to look at his kingdom, what he did, and a little bit about who he was as well. Then we are going to look at the Herodian dynasty. So after Herod the Great dies, then we have his children and his grandchildren who come down after him, who reign over the land of Israel. And I really want to see, more importantly, where these people show up in the New Testament, so we can begin to have an idea who is who. Because quite often they'll just give us the name of Herod. Now obviously the New Testament authors knew exactly who it was, but we don't because we're so far divorced from it. So I want to bring a little bit of clarification concerning that. I want to look at first century Jerusalem, what the land looked like, what the city looked like, particularly in relationship to the Davidic area and the Persian area, to see how it grew and some of the things that were inside it. And then I want to focus on the temple. I want to look at some of Jesus' interactions with the temple in Jerusalem. It was the center of religious life. I can't explain how important it was to Israel as a people. When it was the two times it was destroyed, it's catastrophic. It changes everything. And there's no parallel I can really make with it for Christianity, but it would be something whereby you would have to change your fundamental theology, would have to be altered in order to adapt for an instance like that. And I can't think, but I'll see if I can come up with something. I don't know if something like, I don't want to suggest anything, but it was catastrophically bad. And then after that, I want to look at Jesus' teaching. We're going to talk a little bit about him, his social and religious context. And I want to say focusing mainly on how Jesus' teaching fit in to the social and religious context of the day. And we'll be looking at times when some of his teaching methods, not in too much detail. I went back and forward on this. I didn't know how much I should go into, but it's very wordy and it's quite technical. I don't want to, just bore your eyes off without you doing some work yourselves. I mean, it'd be better if I gave you some worksheets and you came back and you could discuss it. That would be better, but I don't want to kill you in this type of format on Jesus' teaching. So that said, we can begin looking at Herod the Great. No questions. I mean, please stop me if I'm going too fast, if there's something you feel I really need to say. Herod the Great. His father was a man by the name of Antipater, who is probably the most important person, rather than his grandfather, whose name was Antipas. And they have similar names, Antipas and Antipater. But this is probably the most important relative of Herod the Great, because he had strong connections with the government around him. So Antipas was the original, the grandfather. And Antipas would have been the person who would have been directly affected, probably Antipater as well, who would have been directly affected by the Hashemian king Hyrcanus. These are Idumean people, which is to say they were not naturally or considered Jewish people. The area of Idumea is kind of like in the area of Edom. Today it's down kind of to the south and off to more down to the south of Jerusalem and Judah. And these were not Jewish people. These would have been the nations we spoke about, the Hashmoneans before. And these would have been the people that would have been forcefully converted into Judaism. And I say forcefully converted because we don't know exactly what happened. It seems difficult for a nation to forcefully convert another into Judaism. And the general scholarly consensus is such that the Jews, the Hashmonean Empire, made some kind of suzerain alliance with the Idumeans to say, we are going to take over. Yes, some of you guys are going to join our army and we'll rule together. And in order to do that, you guys need to be circumcised. We'll all go under this umbrella of Israel. And you guys have to be circumcised and you guys have to live according to our rules. We won't be enemies and we'll do this together. And it seems as though there was more of an agreement between the two sides more so than a forced conversion. And that's the area, that's one area whereby we need to be careful. I mean, Moshe asked the question about, is there stuff that's heretical? Not so much heretical, but there are the way in which data is presented in historical literature, we have to be very careful about it. So when we read about forced conversion in a book that is pro-Maccabean, then we have to take that with a pinch of salt to think, well, it probably wasn't a conquest as the author is exactly trying to make us believe. And I think there was something a little bit more cordial about this particular agreement. Because if it was a conquest as well, you wouldn't conquer another people and at the same time have their leaders incorporated into your army. That doesn't make sense because these guys are going to be looking for revenge. So that is what happened with the Hashmoneans. And so we have people like Antipas and Antipater. They are incorporated into the Hashmonean army and given a role. So it seems like something more cordial was happening in that situation. Antipater was an official. They were both officials within the Hashmonean army. So they had a position. He was a very intelligent man as well, a smart man, but he had a position in that army. So he had a degree of power going into the situation, and his children naturally would have inherited a lot of that too. And later on, he becomes a general of Pompey. Now Pompey, I said before, was the Roman who came and ended the Hashmonean and also the Greek control over the Levant, over the area of Israel. So he had connections. He understood historically, Antipater understood, even when he was with the Hashmoneans, that ultimately power rested with Rome. He had connections with Rome, the Hashmoneans had connections with Rome, everything was rested with Rome, and he knew that. And so when Rome came over, they conquered the Levant, Antipater was in a fabulous position to inherit a nice piece of control, and indeed that's what happened, because he was granted control over Judah and Israel, the whole of Israel. He was given the Romans, obviously they were quite benevolent actually in their rule. They would take over a place, but they would let local people rule it, so those local people answered to the Rome themselves. And that's what happened here. Antipater was working for the Romans, but he was given control over the north and the south of the old Hashmonean Empire. So in that sense, that kind of leaves us a situation where it's kind of under Jewish control. It's kind of split between the two. And so he's in control of it, he's getting on in years, and he gives his two sons, Phasaelus, he gives the rule of the south, and Herod, he enables to rule up in the Galilee, which, you know, they've given large positions of responsibility, and it was at this stage, when Herod was given control of the north, that Herod was instantly recognized as being a very good administrator, and Rome paid attention to that, and they understood that. They knew that they could just say, manage it, he would be getting their taxes in on time, he would be supplying Rome with everything that they needed, and it wasn't a headache for them to deal with. And that talent was picked up at about this time. Unfortunately for Antipater, he was murdered in 42 AD. Herod the Great suspected that his father was killed by one of the Hashmonean dynasty, Hyrcanus II, who was a leader there. That's what he suspected, and it created distance or a degree of hatred, animosity between Herod the Great and the Hashmoneans. And it was a weird relationship, because Herod the Great knew that in order for him to have the people's loyalty, he had to have some kind of connection or some kind of support with the Hashmonean family as well as with Rome, so he couldn't destroy them all outright, at least not with some kind of good reason. And we'll see how that comes up later on. Yeah. BC, sorry, yes. Oh. That is absolutely a typo. And I apologize for that. I don't know if I should correct it now, actually. You know, let me just correct it now, because that would make things much easier. And then, current slide. Thank you very much. Oh, 42 BC. Keep your eye open, glad it. I'm glad someone's watching. Okay, so Herod the Great, the man himself, has Idumean origins, not a proper Jew, not by blood, so to speak, and that was a point of contention between the Israelites, the people of Israel, and him. They never saw him as being true-blooded, not like the Hashmoneans, so there was a degree of distance between him. Herod amassed huge amounts of wealth for the country, for the nation. He really put the nation on the map. And I'm saying this, I don't want to sound like a Herod apologist, but Herod the Great has a very bad reputation as being this puppet king. So as I present you Herod the Great, understand that from my place, I want to slightly elevate, but I want to talk about some of his better qualities. I'm not saying he wasn't a bad guy, but I'm saying he wasn't wholly bad and wholly destructive, and he does actually have some positive influences over the country. One of them is the amount of wealth he was able to generate from things like tourism in the land of Israel. He absolutely transforms Judah and Israel. He moves the Hashmoneans, made Israel kind of like an important place for Jews. But Herod begins to make it more important for the world, particularly for Rome. And it's only after really Herod's rule that we find historians, other historians, Roman historians, Greek historians, and everything else writing about Israel. One of the biggest problems we've had up until about the first century, the first 50 years of the first century, one of the biggest problems we had is that there is such a paucity of information and data concerning Israel, because the only people who really cared about it were Jews. And when Jews write about their own country, they write fantastic things about their country and the religion and everything else, but we don't have people from outside writing about things that are going on in Israel. But after Herod the Great, we begin to see more and more of this actually happening. We have more and more records, more and more data sources concerning this period. And I put here a puppet king because that is the way he is often portrayed in the literature, purely as a puppet king. I don't want to portray him purely as a puppet king. He had clear responsibilities to Rome. That's where the power was coming from. Rome wasn't going away. Rome owned the world, the best part of the world. So Herod the Great was in with Rome. He had responsibilities for them. And so that's obviously where, you know, if he does something wrong, if he does something like supporting the Jewish people in some way against Rome, then he gets deposed, his family's killed or exiled or something like that, and life's not good for him. So he has responsibilities to Rome, but in addition to that, he also is trying to have some responsibilities for his people, his subjects, the Jewish people in Israel as well. And he doesn't totally neglect them. He is not like the procurators that came after him, and we'll talk about some of those afterwards. So he had responsibility to Rome, yes, but he also did have some inkling and some kind of care, some kind of benevolence towards his own people. So a puppet king, I think, is a little bit of an unfair description of him. He, from a young age, there is, we saw this last week, there are a couple of slides from last week, but we saw this slide from Josephus, that there was a man called Menachem, who was an Essene, who prophesied concerning Herod the Great. And this is from, these references are from the book of Josephus. They're from his volume called Antiquities. And here it mentions that this Essene, whose name was Menachem, and he prophesied, he greeted Herod the Great as king of the Jews when Herod was just a little boy going on the way to school. And he says, "You will be king and will begin your reign happily, for God finds you worthy of it. And do remember the blows that Menachem has given you as being a signal of the change of your fortune." So we've got a source here, we've got Josephus saying that Herod was basically, was prophesied that he was going to be king. So I don't know altogether how Josephus viewed him, but here, to mention something like this would suggest that Josephus didn't hate Herod as he hated, let's say, the Zealots or something like that. Herod's wives, a number of wives. He married a woman named Cleopatra. Not that Cleopatra. That Cleopatra from the Egyptians, from the Ptolemaic dynasty, she was involved with Mark Antony. Mark Antony was a friend of Herod. We'll see that relationship in a moment. But he married a woman called Cleopatra, another woman called Malthais, who was Idumean, half Idumean and half Samaritan. And from this woman he had Herod Antipas and Herod Archelaus. Those are both Herods that we will see later on. So those are two important children that he had from this woman here. He also married Mariam II, the daughter of Simon the high priest. Now the thing here, this woman here that he married, she was a Hashmonean. She was of Hashmonean blood. That kind of brought about a few difficulties, but at least it was a show by Herod that Herod is trying to join onto this dynasty in order to gain some kind of respect from the people. The son they had there is Herod Philip. We'll see what happens to him. Mariam the Second, my bad, I'm confused there. Mariam the First was Hashmonean, not Mariam the Second. She was Hashmonean. These sad faces represent death. These are the people that Herod actually killed. She was Hashmonean. He joined with her, together with her, in order to look like he was joining onto the Hashmonean dynasty. And that caused nothing but problems, because he, as he grew older, he became paranoid. And he then decided to think that it would have been the Hashmonean dynasty that was going to overthrow him. So there were phases where he ran, he became very paranoid, and he killed a number of his children and his wife. And then he has another wife, Doris, who gives birth to Antipater II, and that's another one that was killed by Herod, Herod the Great. And most of this happens towards the end of his life. But that was a problematic issue, mainly because of the Hashmonean blood. And that idea of Herod versus the Hashmoneans would have been something that would have been picking up and building up ever since Herod came into power. He was always a bit nervous of how that was going to go down. So when we look at Herod the Great and these wives here, and I believe the likelihood is he had more wives than these. This is just a small section. Those I thought was more important. But the likelihood is that when you look at this, and you have to look at this as well, and when you read the Bible, as you read the Old Testament particularly, when you read about David and his wives, you should always take a look and to see where they're from. Are they from a particular tribe, a particular people? Because what's going on oftentimes is these wives spring out of a necessity to make alliances with other people. And you do that by marrying somebody in power. And the same thing happens even today, where I think it's in Jordan and Egypt that got a situation where I think it was the king of Egypt, his daughter married someone from Jordan, and Jordan married somebody there. And in order, they do that in order to create some kind of family alliance, and it breeds a degree of loyalty between peoples as well. And that, a lot of that is going on in this particular case here, particularly with the Samaritan Idumean and Hashmonean connections of his wives. His rise to power. Let me just quickly mention about this view. For any of you interested in going to the archaeological dig next year, this is the view which we had from pretty much from our room for our guest house. So it was all the way up by Migdal, but the guest house, you'd come out and you'd see these, and these are the caves, the cliffs of Arbel. And we actually did, we went up there one morning as well, the first morning of the dig. So these are the cliffs of Arbel, very high, and there are a number of caves around here, up and down, and people used to go in and hide there, and we'll see more about that in just a second. So that's the view. The cliffs of Arbel. Beautiful to actually go to, just in case you're thinking about it, there's some encouragement. Herod began, as I mentioned, as governor of the Galilee. He was incredibly good at this job, incredibly efficient, ran things very, very well, and that was recognized quickly by Rome. Whilst he was governor, whilst he was managing the upper part, there was a rebellion, or a series of rebellions, by a man called Hezekiah. Hezekiah had a band of troops, and they were creating a degree of upset. Some people think they were anti-Roman as well, but ultimately, his band of men, his rebellion, a lot of them took refuge here in the cliffs of Arbel, in these caves. And there's a long story in Josephus, and he records of how Herod the Great was had a number of soldiers, and they would lower them in baskets in order to get to some of these caves in order to pull the people out to kill them. But he basically quells this rebellion, and he captures Hezekiah and all of his men. Now these, many people believe, were kind of the proto-zealots. The proto-zealots. These were the people that the zealots really picked up from. Their spirit of rebellion seems to have been began here. And there was a man, Judah, who I mentioned before, Judah the Galilean, who they believed was Hezekiah's son. So that really began the whole zealots movement, their actions there. Even though Herod brought he brought him to justice, took his men, and he basically killed them all. He destroyed them all. Many people believe unlawfully. It was a bunch of rebels. He made examples of all of them. And as a result, he was brought to trial by the Sanhedrin. We'll talk about the Sanhedrin, but it was kind of like an organized judging body. And he was brought before them and basically got away with it with Rome's help. Now this I mention now because it creates a situation, it creates a degree of tension later on because he comes back and carries out revenge on a number of the Sanhedrin. But it also creates a problem because when we see Herod the Great, he doesn't do much development work in the Galilee. Most of his work is centered around Judah and along the coast, but he seems to stay well away from the Galilee, and that's Herod the Great. 40 to 37 BC, we have the Parthian invasion into Israel. They invade Syria first, threaten Israel, and Herod and his brother, still relatively young, they were captured because Antipater was obviously the man responsible for that northern area as well. Herod is able to escape and he flees to Rome during this invasion. And this is part of a much larger battle between the Parthians and the Romans. So he flees to Rome. On his way, he goes via Masada and he stays there for a while. And then he flees to Rome. And whilst he's in Rome, he has a very good friend whose name is Mark Antony. That's the Mark Antony who was involved with Cleopatra from Egypt. Very good relationship with him. Mark Antony is kind of like a almost like an emperor. He's a very powerful man, and Herod is promised kingship. He says, Rome says, you go back there, take so many soldiers, and take it from the Parthians, chase them all the way back, and take control of that area. And that is when he goes back, and after a series of wars, he returns to Jerusalem, and he takes it after a long siege. So now the deal is done. Herod is made king over Israel, over the whole country. His brother was killed, so he's the last of the Herods left. So he takes over Israel and begins ruling, and that's when the phases of his kingship begin. And there are normally three phases of his kingship that we look at. His initial kingship, what he did in the first few years, establishing and really solidifying his reign. Then there's a period of stability and peace, from about 25 to 13. Those dates go downwards because we're looking at AD, before Christ, so they go downwards to zero and then back upwards afterwards. And then we look at the decline of King Herod from 13 through to 4. That's going to be 13 BC to 4 AD. And that covers the birth of Christ. And that's generally, those are the three main areas. If you're looking at Herod the Great, that's how we look at his life. And we'll see the things which he did in just a moment. We'll start with the initial kingship. The land wasn't this large. At first, he just began with just this area here, Judah, Samaria, and the Galilee. The first thing he does as king was he has to weaken the Hasmonean stronghold. The memory of the Hasmoneans does not go away. It's everywhere. When you read the New Testament, it is in there all of the time. The memory of Jewish rulers running Israel, the Jewish state, and they got it through rebellion. That is in there. That's in the whole of the New Testament. That spirit is there, particularly in the Gospels. So Herod has to weaken the Hasmonean stronghold over Israel. He has to begin to either adopt their life onto himself and own it, or he has to kill influential figures. He gains access to the priesthood. Now, he doesn't take priesthood for himself. That's what the Hasmoneans did. The Hasmoneans were priestly kings. They brought the two things together. Herod doesn't do this, but he does take control to the priesthood. He doesn't want Hasmoneans back in the priesthood in positions of power. And so he actually brings his own people in to begin with to become priests. The 45 members of the Sanhedrin, those that were responsible for convicting him earlier on, he comes back and he executes them. Any trace, anybody against him, he's got to stamp down, because he has to, either through paranoia or he has to establish his own kingship. He institutes his own high priest, a man called Hananel, and this was a man from Babylon. He throughout his whole reign, he's bringing people from Babylon to populate the area, people who he knows, he recognizes to support him should there a war break out. A lot of the people don't like this appointing for the high priest, and so he's pressured to install Aristobulus, Mariam's brother, Mariam the First, the Hasmonean. So now for a brief period, we've got a Hasmonean who stands as priest, which is a position of leadership over Israel. And this causes certain problems, and so he arranges for his murder. He invites him down to his summer palace in Jericho and has him drowned. He's assassinated there. Now there is a big furor over this, and he is tried and accused, but because Mark Antony is behind him in Rome, he gets away with it scot-free. So he's able to quell this potential Hasmonean taking over the priesthood. During this period, because of his connection with Mark Antony, he is gradually given more and more territory, more and more land. And the thing with having more and more land and controlling more regions It's about money and it's about wealth. The larger area you have, the larger tax revenue you have. Yes, it's good for the Romans, but the Romans weren't getting all of the benefits because you got to cream some for yourself because you were managing things. So the larger area generates so much more wealth. He began here, but he's added districts like, not Phoenicia, but this district around here. This would be Iturea. The Decapolis is also added, Perea, everything west of the Jordan he begins to gain. Then during his initial early kingship, there are battles with this area here, the Nabataeans. Now the Nabataeans were kind of like a desert people, and it was the Nabataeans who were responsible for, and it would have been around about this kind of time, maybe a bit later, who were responsible for Petra. Those were the Nabataeans. That's the kind of generation we're dealing with. Aristeas III, Aristeas IV, it would have been in that kind of area. But he fought in a series of wars against the Nabataeans and finally was able to defeat them conclusively at Amman, which is over here in Jordan, modern-day Jordan. Now, at the same time this was going on, Mark Antony was sharing leadership with Octavian, an emperor. And they got into a large battle because obviously these things don't work when you've got two people sharing leadership, one person has to gain control. They go into a large battle, and Mark Antony was actually defeated by Octavian. He was defeated by him, and Herod was a huge supporter of Mark Antony. So, what happened after his defeat? Well, Octavian, Herod the Great, obviously was in a bit of trouble because he was supporting Mark Antony in this battle. Mark Antony is defeated, but Octavian recognizes that Herod the Great is a loyal individual, an incredibly loyal individual. And as a result, he says, okay, Herod, I understand you were against me. Now, if you'll work for me, I'll let you keep this land. And that's exactly what he does. And so Herod remains now working for Octavian. Octavian is the emperor who had a very, very large and successful rule and is given more territory. I think that's when he was given the Decapolis after that. So the situation kind of stabilizes. Herod the Great is running the nation at this time. And it's at this time we have the period of stability and peace from 25 through to 13. What happens? His kingdom is further expanded. The height of his kingdom was about 23, the year 23 BC. He further relocates more Jews from Babylon. The bigger the area you have to have more of your guys in there managing things. So he brings a number of people in from Babylon, and then he begins rebuilding and rebuilding and rebuilding and rebuilding and building and building. This is the period in which Herod the Great goes crazy and redevelops the nation of Israel. Many building projects, we're going to take a look at a number of them. He strengthened fortresses, one at Dor and one at Masada. Dor is a coastal town up in between kind of like Haifa and Tel Aviv. He strengthens a fortress there, the remains of that palace. And he strengthens, more importantly, Masada. Masada, that was a big deal. We'll take a look at that in a moment. He rebuilds settlements and villages. Caesarea, that's Caesarea Maritima, a large village, was a village, a large city it became. And also Sebaste, we're going to look at that as well, which is basically Samaria. And he began whole new settlements. He built towns as well. He changes the face of Israel. He really changes the face of Israel, and his fingerprints are all over the country. Masada, we don't hear of it at all in the New Testament, granted, but it's a very important place. It's a mountain fortress in the middle of the desert. And it was the place where Herod first escaped to when he escaped the Parthian invasion. He went there, he stayed there for a while. And then he went back and redeveloped it as a fortress. He had soldiers there that would manage it, that would keep it stocked up for him. That's what it looks like. If you go back, this northern palace up here is this area up here. And as you can see, it's very difficult to get to. Very difficult to get to. There is a ramp where you can go up from the side, but it's, you know, other than that, it's pretty much isolated. This area here is what a reconstruction of what that front part looked like, and this was basically a palace. He had a palace there where he would go. It's always warm, 12 months a year. You can go there, and it's going to have nice weather, so it was a place where he would have gone for vacation as well. Part of Herod's construction, and this is interesting, is that we see a number of mikvaot. This is a mikvah, one of those ritual baths which we mentioned, which you would go in and you would wash, you'd totally immerse yourself, go down one end, come up the other, and be clean. This is important because if Herod the Great built this, it shows he would have had some kind of connection to the Jewish people. He wasn't entirely devoid of the practices and everything else, and he at least went through some kind of at least a facade of following Jewish ritual. And there were a number of these found in Masada, which is quite important. But there were also regular pools and baths, which he would have used as well. Which raised the big question, how do you get water on top of a mountain? And this is where the genius, and this is where listen, you're going to get 100 people come here and speak about Herod the Great. They're going to speak about a puppet king who was evil and cruel and he punished everybody. You get me, and I'm going to recognize this man's genius and this man's ingenuity and say it wasn't all bad. So one of the things he did was they were able to run from the mountains, which had been over here. They had channels of water, so when it rained, they could collect water. It would run down the side of the mountain, and it would hit a channel of water, and it would roll down the side of the mountain into streams, and then it would fall into these holes here. All along the side, there are holes. These are reservoirs. So the water would go down the mountain, it would go along the side of the mountain, and it would fall into these. And there's another tract running down here, and there were holes there. And these look like small, tiny holes to you, but inside there were these huge water reservoirs. And so the flash floods that occurred, water was kept, and they were able to store huge amounts of water. And from here, they would have, they had donkeys, and they had long ropes that would go into the reservoirs and pull the water up to use it up here. So the pools, and that there was no lack of supply, the pools and the mikvaot had a constant supply of water all year round. And this was genius. And this was something which he did here in Masada, and we'll see he did it in other places as well. Regarding getting water to towns and villages as they expanded was something which he did extremely well. This place here, Caesarea, we have an artist's rendition of what it looked like back in Herod's day. This was another place which he built. It was a small fishing village, but he totally revamped it. He totally redeveloped it. It had to be very impressive because when Romans came over by sea, the first place they came to was the port of Caesarea. So it had to be very impressive, and it had to be very Roman. And indeed it was. And this artist's rendition, it shows the Roman streets going up and down, the blocks, just like Manhattan. Everything is in line, and everything is organized, and it was indeed a polis. Jesus is never recorded as being in Caesarea. It was a Roman town. We don't find Jesus in Roman towns very much. in the Gospels, the remains of this, I said that was a reconstruction. This is what remains of it today. So you can kind of, the excavations are quite large, and you can kind of make out a lot of these streets in this town in any event. I mentioned Herod's genius concerning water. One of the things he did to increase the water supply here was he built a couple of aqueducts like this that went up about 10 kilometers to the base of Mount Carmel. And these are channels that took water from springs 10 kilometers away all the way down into Caesarea to provide it with fresh water. So he channeled water in there. He also had a system of channeling the seawater through the lower levels of the city to act as sewage. So they had places where natural sewage, you know, would build up, but it would be washed out, funneled, and washed away into the sea, which helped keep the city clean and fresh. And this is revolutionary. This is really revolutionary technology that he was introducing to this land. In doing this, he brings fame to Israel. Not just this here, but also Masada. You'll see what he does in the temple in Jerusalem just a moment. But he is bringing fame to Israel. This is an amphitheater which is still intact. It's still in use today. It's here somewhere. There's a temple. I can't locate it now. There's a theater that was built. And that is one of the pieces that makes Caesarea what we call a polis. A polis is going to be like an official Roman town that's run in a particular way. And a polis had to have certain features, one of which was a theater. It had to have what's called a cardo, which is a major north-south route, a cardo maximus, and that's what it is there. And the idea here is that any Roman that comes to the city would automatically feel at home. It would feel just like he was in a Roman town or he was in Rome. He would come there. He knows that there was going to be a cardo. There was going to be a theater. There was going to be a temple. We've got a temple of Augustus. The layout, it was going to be horizontal and vertical roads. All of this contributes towards that as well. Now, though Jesus wasn't caught here, Paul was taken captive here. A number of things happen here, actually. We have Cornelius' conversion in Acts 10. If you remember when Peter had that vision of the sheets coming down with the food and God saying, eat, and he says, I ain't going to touch that, that's not kosher, and it happens three times. Well, Peter ends up coming to Caesarea, where he meets Cornelius, and he goes into Cornelius' house, a Gentile's house. So that is one of the events that happened in this particular location. But in Acts as well, certainly by Acts 18, we know that a church is established here as well, amidst a Roman city. When he had landed at Caesarea, this is Paul, he went up and greeted the church, and then went down to Antioch. So there was a church that met here as well. There were believers established, and it's where Paul was kept in prison, Acts 24, I think for about 2 years before he was shipped off to Rome. Sorry. I'll let you get that information down. The Pilate inscription, which was found in Caesarea, very important inscription, because on it, it mentions Pontius Pilate. This is Latin, and it looks a bit faded too, but we can see to the divine Augusti, that's what we can see, Tiberium, Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judah, has dedicated this. I think it was a temple building that was part of an inscription of it. One of the things it does is it lends us with external evidence, inscription evidence of Pontius Pilate. And this would have been a place that Pilate would have been, he would have spent a great deal of time in. It would have been one of the major cities of the country. You've got to think, for us as Christians, Jerusalem is the most important place in the world. But for many of these Romans, they couldn't care. They want to be in the Roman surroundings. They want to have Roman baths. They want to have everything Roman. So these were the places that a lot of the leaders would have remained in. he fortified Samaria. Not so important. Samaria was a very important town from a locational point of view, from a battle point of view. There's not much of it left. It's called Sebaste. There's still signs of an amphitheater there. Hasn't really been excavated that well, but again, it shows it would have looked like a Roman polis, which is what he was doing. And Herod, we're going to look more about Jerusalem later on, but Herod, this, we look at these walls here. This is what Jerusalem looked like during the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. The Hashemites built up around here and down here. So they expanded it. And then Herod the Great built this wall here. And this is what we call the second wall. And that's the third one. But we'll look at that more later on. Something else which Herod did in his reconstruction of the temple, which is very important as well. Again, he revamped the water system. These are three pools in Bethlehem, and they're called, as most things are in Israel, they're erroneously named, but these are called Solomon's pools. They're not Solomon's pools at all. They were, I believe, they're constructed around about the time of Herod the Great, or the Hashemites maybe before him, but he certainly had a hand in revamping this system. There are three reservoirs that collect spring water from the mountains around about the region of Bethlehem. And that's where the pools that we've just seen are located. And they run along sides of the mountain. And they go all the way around here, up here, all the way to the temple. It's just perfectly layered so that it is a very slight incline all the way along sides of mountains, along various pipes, and it goes all the way. And so you've got all the rainfall here that collects, and you've got a constant stream of water going to the temple in Jerusalem. Sorry? To 744. Yes, it's going down very gradually, very, very gradually, along the side of a hill. Not up would be impressive for Herod even, but it goes down. It goes down all the side. It's important to remember for the temple. We don't think about the temple was a place where throughout the year, the three major feasts during Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot, there were thousands and thousands of people coming to Jerusalem, to the temple. And they would have been doing what? They would have been sacrificing. So you would have had priests working constantly, cutting open animals. There would have been blood spilling everywhere. It needs a huge amount of water to keep it clean. And so this would have been used in conjunction with other means of collecting and shoveling, funneling water around Jerusalem. But the bigger the temple, the more people coming, the more you need this water to actually deal with things. Herod builds a palace about here in Jerusalem, a large palace. This is just a reconstruction of it. And you've got, he names the tower, this tower after his wife, and this one after his brother, Fizael. He names the towers, and these are still kind of available today, visible today. Just this basement area here is part of the Fasael Tower, if I'm not mistaken. So some is available. And today, as I said before, they consistently name things badly, but today this is called David's Citadel, but it really has nothing to do with David whatsoever, but that's just an Israeli and an Israel tourism thing. Herod's temple. Concerning the temple, we'll go into more detail about it later. He who has not seen the temple of Herod has never seen in his life, seen a beautiful building. And this is from Bava Batra in the Talmud. But this was an expression because the temple would have been considered possibly one of the wonders of the world. You have to go and see it. And this is, just to take a preliminary look at it right now, this is what it looked like. And it was a redevelopment of what was down there before. There were a couple of gates on the other side here, and you would come up into the main temple complex from the ground. And there were other entrances around here too. And we're going to talk about this more. For now, I want to just say, concerning Herod's part of it, this is the original Temple Mount area. This area was added by the Hashmoneans. Herod the Great basically extended the platform out here to make it this much larger. So he really, really, really made it much, much bigger. They set up retaining walls on the side and filled this with bits of rock and everything else in order to make a sturdy platform. This over here would be what is today the Western Wall. So there's nothing, when you look at the Western Wall, there's actually nothing immediately next to it. But we do have, if you could dig there, this is an archaeologist's dream to be able to dig under here so you could begin to uncover Solomon's temple, Solomon's and all of his constructions. And that's the rock, which is where the Dome of the Rock is built today. We'll talk more, much more about that later on. As far as the Jews are concerned, we have this area here, which Herod also built, which is called the Fortress of Antonia, also called the Baris, which is built, and it's basically a Roman, small Roman mini fort, because if there was going to be a rebellion in Israel, it was going to begin here at the temple. And with so many people, so you've got during the feast, you've got so many people coming in, that they had to police the temple precincts. And there's a lot of kind of like tension involved about Romans spying and seeing everything that goes on in the temple, which was essentially a holy place. So that was not, wasn't appreciated hugely at all. This is the reconstruction of the southern wall. We'll look at this in more detail when we look at the temple. We're going to ask these questions. I want to go for about an hour and take a few minutes break, so let me finish with these questions concerning Herod and the big question concerning his rule, which is simply why. Why did he build so much? One is a question of extravagance. He was a man with flair. He did like to do things, big things. So that was a part of his character. The second one is his name and legacy. We know that he cared very much about his legacy. Concerning a command, something which he did about his death. We're going to read about that in a moment. But at his death, he did something. We threatened to do something that would ensure that his legacy was going to be maintained. But we'll talk about that later on. He wanted to endear himself to Rome, which explains places like Caesarea. He wanted to be shown to be somebody who cared for Roman things, to attract as well important Romans into the area, because that all helps to generate wealth and popularity and fame for the nation. He also, and this you can see is a big difference between Herod and Pontius Pilate and the prefects. He wanted to please the people more, hence the temple and hence the revamping generally of Jerusalem. He did care about the people. He wasn't totally oblivious to them. So he was trying to maintain the balance, and I think this is part of his genius in the fact that he could maintain the two. It was only Herod that was able to maintain this empire and keep the Romans happy. And once you see that he, after his death, then things go start to fall to pieces. To expand tourism and to expand revenue is another huge part of all of this building. And he did it. He did it quite successfully. There was money being generated. People were coming. The country was expanding. It was relatively popular. It was quite an affluent time. Even though we don't see it at the moment, it was quite an affluent time. And this is something that happens to many leaders. They're normally, oftentimes, you don't appreciate a leader until he's gone, or you don't appreciate the wealth that they've generated for the country until they're dead and gone. All you see is the negative things that happen around. So this is my my take, again, my presentation of Herod the Great. Let's pause there. It's about an hour, and then we're going to come back and we're going to find out what happened in his during his decline and what happened after his death. So let's take five. Yes, questions. Two questions. Oh, wow. Two. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I think Herod was more concerned with religion as far as it would further his purposes. I don't think he was particularly religious. He did some things to, like when they first constructed the temple, I believe they put an eagle, a golden eagle, up on the entrance to the temple. So he didn't really, I don't think he was really committed, but he understood it was serious for the people, so he kind of went to appease it, to endear himself to them as well. That's two questions. The mikveh, the ritual bath, was something that was going on before Herod the Great. That's something which traditional, that's one of the things I think I want to actually say, that the mikveh, the ritual bath, was something that was part of normative Judaism. Everybody knew what it was. Everybody did it. From Pharisees, Sadducees, priests, everybody would have done that. So that's just a part of what they do. And we've seen when you go to the temple, we'll see at the bottom of the temple there are a number of mikvahot. When you go, you cleanse yourself before you go up into the temple area. Absolutely, yes. Absolutely, they have mikvahot. I knew the security guard that I talked to him often, who was he was like Orthodox. But he would tell me he would be there from about 7 o'clock at the kindergarten, and he would tell me before he went in the mornings he would go and he would immerse himself, and you go in, you have to be totally immersed, and you would come out before work. He would do it on a daily basis, so it is something done. Yes. Right. There is a clear link between the two. How ritual immersion was taken, everybody did it, but how it was understood by different groups differed. The way in which the Essenes view it was different to the way in which the Pharisees may have viewed it and everybody else. But when John comes from wherever he was in the Dead Sea, he starts baptizing people. It's not a brand new thing. Now he's throwing water on people. It's something that he is now doing, but he gives a special significance to it. It's a baptism of repentance for the kingdom of heaven. That's the difference. It's a baptism of repentance, which you do, which you're really going to do once, which signifies, obviously, what's going to come, the kingdom of heaven. So it was something which was technically old going on, but he brings it new significance, a brand new significance. Yeah. And so that was that baptism is very important. Now, if you can ask the question, do I think even after the disciples were baptized, did they still go into a ritual bath? I think they actually did. I think they would have done. I think they did everything pretty much according to what they did before, even though they had had this baptism. And I'm not suggesting we have to go into mikvah or anything like that. I'm saying our baptism is enough. But it's a development of Jewish tradition as opposed to something brand new. Certain motion. Okay, he wasn't perfect. He was perfect. Okay. If you wait 2 hours, we're going to get there. No stronghold, evidence of.
Are they more of the Pharisees than in the ruling councils, or is it the zealots?
No, I'm thinking more in terms of not so much as people, as in they create a degree of tension because they were kind of ousted, but there are many Hashemites still around. And so they raise the tension within the New Testament of rebellion and overthrowing the Romans. So when you read about the Romans wanting to stamp down on people really quickly and harshly, it's because the Romans know there's this dynasty that's still around. They could come, and so they want to get on it really, really quickly. And you got to think as well, the priests are scared of it as well, because the priests know the Hashemites, well, one, Hashemites take over, they could lose their jobs, and they're going to upset everything. So that the tension of their existence and the potential of what could happen is just in the New Testament. And so all the priests are edgy, not so much a Hashemian, but that was part of the whole, he could lead a revolt. Those are the types of fears that were around it. It was very, very tense in those days regarding that. Which are different. We're talking about the pool of Siloam, Shiloh, different. Different. Solomon's pools are in Bethlehem. You're talking about something that's in Jerusalem. Yeah. Solomon's pools are just like, yeah, they're all the way in Bethlehem, miles away. Okay. With that, let's take 10 minutes and we'll come back and we'll see how Herod the Great died.